We're speaking now with Mary Costello. She's Executive Director of the Rock Creek Alliance, which was formed many years ago to oppose the proposed Rock Creek Mine, which would be just outside of Noxon, Montana, and discharge its effluent into the Clark Fork River just above Lake Ponderay. Mary, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure, Chris. I'm happy to talk with you today.
So there have been a couple of significant developments in these past couple of months on the status of approval of the mine, and that's what we're going to talk about today. But first, for our listeners who may not be familiar, tell us more about what exactly the mine proposal is and also what the Rock Creek Alliance is about.
Happy to. Well, the proposal first really surfaced way back in 1995, and there, of course, there was a period of public comment and public involvement, but ultimately the Forest Service and Montana DEQ issued a permits for the mine back in 2001. So it's of course been 20 years, but the mine has never moved forward, basically due to our legal challenges along the way. As you mentioned, the mine would be located near Noxon, Montana. Importantly, it would be constructed beneath the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness, and that's something that's unusual. If the mine is built, it would be the first major mine beneath a wilderness area, a federally protected area. It would be an underground copper-silver mine and would basically produce 10,000 tons of ore per day. You mentioned some of the risks from the mine, and of concern to your listeners is the polluted discharge that the mine would create. This would be a daily discharge. You know, over the course of a number of years, we've seen a lot of numbers thrown around, but potentially up to 3 million gallons a day, and that pollution would contain nutrients and heavy metals. And what's of most concern is the fact that this is a perpetual discharge. So it's not like they start polluting when they start mining and then it stops at the end of construction. Once that underground mine cavity is open, there will be a continual discharge into the Clark Fork River and then, of course, on down into Lake Ponderay, which, again, is a huge concern. Some of the other risks involve the mine tailings. They would produce up to 100 million tons of mine tailings at the end of mine life. And those tailings would be put in an impoundment right next to the Clark Fork River. And one of the problems is the construction method that they're using has been shown in other areas to be unstable and unsafe. There's also a risk of acid mine drainage. It is a sulfur ore body. And, of course, there's going to be impacts to the wilderness, especially some of the lakes and streams that are at risk of dewatering. So those are some of the main things that jump out. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of other impacts to wildlife and to local economies. But for folks in Sandpoint, you know, of major concern is that long-term discharge into the lake. A little bit about our history. We were formed in 1997, again, because of the risk of water quality. And we started out in Sandpoint, but we also had and still do have a satellite office in Montana. And we utilized public advocacy and scientific reviews of the project. But ultimately, we got into legal challenges, and, you know, that's a really our only way at this point of opposing the mine. And as you mentioned, we are in the midst of litigation and have been for the last several years. But I think the key thing is to understand that, you know, this has been going on for over 20 years. It's a long time. The fight is not over, and we still are in court hoping to stop this thing through legal action.
Well, you told us about the potential impacts on water quality in Lake Ponderay, but it's worth mentioning as the proposed mine would be right at the edge of the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness, and as you mentioned, it would act, the mine itself would go under the wilderness. What are some of the impacts that you would project on the wilderness and wildlife?
Well, obviously, as I did mention, you know, there's that risk of dewatering, basically because when they excavate the underground mine, the water is has to come from somewhere, so it would come from above, from wilderness lakes and streams. And because of that, some of these streams like the East Forkable River, Rock Creek, and some of the lakes, Chicago Creek, St. Paul Lake, they would be at risk of serious dewatering, in some cases long-term dewatering, and potentially not recovering at all. So that's a huge concern. And obviously there's displacement of wildlife, there's impacts to bull trout and grizzly bears, which, you know, I will talk a little bit more when we talk about our Endangered Species Act case. For people who like to recreate in the wilderness, they're going to experience basically an operation that's 24/7 when the mine's operating. There'll be industrial noise and light, traffic. Access to the wilderness would be difficult going up Rock Creek. So, you know, people that like to just go and hunt or pick huckleberries, they would see that it's not a quiet place anymore. It's not the wilderness that we know of today.
Okay, well, let's get into some of these couple recent developments that we've had. In mid-April, a U.S. judge struck down the government's approval of the first phase of this proposed mine. Can you tell us, you know, what the basis for that decision was and give us a little more information on that?
Okay, so you're referring to the Endangered Species Act case. Which is a challenging the Fish and Wildlife Service's biological opinion for the mine, as well as the authorization from the Forest Service for the mine to proceed, because it would be on Forest Service land, part of it. So just sort of as some background, obviously there would be impacts to grizzly bears and bull trout, and they're both listed species. So that means the Fish and Wildlife Service has to write a biological opinion in order for the mine to go forward. They have to assess the impacts, and then in some cases they write a take statement that says it's okay to kill X number of individuals, and they have come up with mitigation measures. And through the course of this long project, there have been, I think, about 7 different biological opinions. The first one was issued in 2000. The latest one is a 2009 supplemental biop, a biological opinion. So basically, back in 2019, we entered into litigation challenging the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision not to reinitiate consultation on the current biological opinion. At the time, it was the 2017 supplement. And the reason we did that was that there were some new circumstances that had arisen. And one of those was that there were new data that came out that talked about this permanently reducing flows in Rock Creek and the East Forkable River, which is critical for bull trout. That's bull trout habitat, some of its critical habitat. And these streams already occasionally experience low flow periods. So for that dewatering to occur from the mine, that would have major impacts on bull trout, which had not been considered in the 2017 opinion. The other problem was back in 2007, the Fish and Wildlife Service, as part of the mitigation for the mine, decided that they needed to somehow reduce grizzly bear mortality. Because even without a mine, there's, of course, people are aware of this. There's poaching of grizzly bears. Bears are dying. This is a very small population in the Cabinet Mountains. There's an estimate of maybe 30 bears, and that might not even be accurate at this point. So they hired a person to come on board and try to mitigate those losses of bears prior to the mine's construction, which they know would cause more mortality. This person was basically to work with local communities, teach people how to live in bear country, use bear-proof containers, sort of some common sense approaches to living in bear country. After more than 10 years, they have found that none of these methods have been successful, and bear mortality continues to rise. So when you have a population that small and isolated, you can't have any more mortality of bears and expect the population to survive. So it was evident that that mitigation measure that was associated with the earlier biological opinions was not being effective, and they were not addressing that. And then sort of the last thing that came up was the fact that there's no fish passage at the Cabinet Gorge Dam. I'm sure most of your listeners are aware that the Cabinet Gorge Dam is right on the border of Montana and Idaho. It's actually in Idaho. And historically, bull trout migrated between Pend Oreille into some of the stream reaches in the lower Clark Fork River, including in Montana. That was historically, but because there's a dam there, the populations in the lower Clark Fork River in Montana have been isolated from Pend Oreille. So as part of the biological opinion, it was always assumed that fish passage was going to occur, and this was all through the relicensing that was done on the Avista's dams. That still has not occurred. So we filed, and in response to our complaint, the Fish and Wildlife Service, they withdrew that biological opinion in 2017. And they came out with a new one, a 2019 supplemental opinion. But they still did not address the mortality for grizzly bears. And the other thing they did is they tried to downplay the harm to local bull trout populations by lumping the lower Clark Fork River populations into what they called the Lake Pend Oreille Recovery Unit, which sounds good, but if there's not fish passage, it doesn't mean anything. It's not based on sound science. It's just a way of making things look better than they really are. And then the other thing that they did was they decided, and this is the first time, and this is their seventh opinion, that they're not going to really assess the impacts to grizzly bear and bull trout from the full mine. They're just going to look at phase one, which is the evaluation at it. And most of the impacts are going to occur during the construction and the operation of the mine, not during the first phase. So Judge Malloy, who has been taking cases on the mine, you know, basically from day one and has seen many of these biological opinions, looked at this and agreed with us. And basically, in his opinion, he said, you know, we've been looking at this as a two-phase project. You know, it's been analyzed and permitted and planned as a two-phase, and now all of a sudden the agency just wants to look at phase one. And, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. So that was good news for us. So basically what this decision did was it revoked not only the biological opinion, but the Forest Service's authorization for the mine to move forward. So at this point, there's nothing that they can do except appeal the decision, which I just learned yesterday that the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service are appealing, as is Hecla Mining Company. So that will be the next step, will be defending our decision in the Ninth Circuit.
And you just gave us a pretty long history of these legal cases, and they are complicated. So what do you expect, like, the time frame now for an appeal to go forward?
Wow. Well, you know, I'm trying to recall. We actually were at the Ninth Circuit a number of years ago appealing a decision on one of the former biological opinions, and I think it was a couple of years. And I really don't know what the caseload is at the Ninth Circuit. And because this just came out yesterday, I mean, I just got notice from our attorneys yesterday that this was happening. We haven't had a chance, the client groups have not had a chance to really talk with them to get an idea. I do know that Hecla has been saying publicly that they didn't think they were going to do anything for a number of years. So I don't think this is going to be resolved. I would be surprised if it would be resolved in less than a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But again, that's kind of an uninformed guess on my part.
Okay. Well, that's that particular case. Let's turn to another development that just came down this month, June, in fact, where a Montana judge has issued a ruling that Hecla is subject to what's called the bad actor law. So tell us what that is about.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, these cases are really complicated and ongoing, and there's a lot of different iterations, and so sometimes it's hard to really boil it down and keep it simple. So I will try my best on this.
You're doing fine in that respect because they are complicated and this kind of background is really helpful.
I have to sort of remind myself where we are in the process. So as you mentioned, Montana has what's known as a bad actor law. It's part of Montana's Metal Mine Reclamation Act, and it's actually kind of a unique law, and it was actually enacted with bipartisan support under former Governor Judy Martz, and the reason was because we had some messes that were left behind for the taxpayers in Montana to clean up. The situation that we became aware of a couple years ago was that Phillips Baker, who is Hecla's CEO, was the chief financial officer of Pegasus Gold up until the time that that company went bankrupt back in 1998. And that bankruptcy left millions in liability at four mines. The most notorious was the Zortman and Landusky mines. And to date, those mines have cost taxpayers over $74 million, and the cleanup costs continue because this is one that has acid mine drainage, and these mines are going to be discharging likely in perpetuity. So when we discovered that Mr. Baker had ties to Pegasus, we sent Montana DEQ, our attorney, sent them a letter kind of outlining his involvement. And so DEQ looked into it, and then in March of, it was 2018, they sent an actual enforcement letter to Hecla Mining and to Phillips Baker stating that for them to operate, to open up a new mine in Montana, they have to clean up the past mess plus interest. So they have to go back and they have to reclaim those sites and pay for water treatment. And, of course, both Phillips Baker and the company basically disavowed any responsibility, said that it was another mining company, had nothing to do with them, and they sued DEQ. So DEQ countersued, and we actually intervened on their behalf, which is kind of an unusual place for us to be, because usually we're challenging some decision, but they were doing the right thing here. And we were joined with some of our partners, conservation partners in Montana, as well as the Fort Belknap Indian community. And they're involved basically because the Zortman Landusky mines have really impacted their community. So they signed on, as well as the Crazy Dog Society of the Kootenai Band of Indians. So we had, basically a lot of parties interested in this litigation. So the case was heard in state court, and we received a favorable ruling in which the court basically dismissed Hecla's motion. They were looking for some summary judgment against DEQ. So we won a good decision there, but then Phillips Baker and the company, they went back to court and wanted to dismiss the complaints because what they were arguing was the Montana courts don't have jurisdiction over us. This law doesn't apply to us because our company is headquartered in Idaho, and Phillips Baker lives in Idaho. He's not a Montana resident. And initially, last summer, the court actually bought into that, and they granted a motion to dismiss the case for what they call a lack of jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction. So DEQ went back in, and we, of course, were part of this challenge to the ruling, and basically argued that, both Baker and Hecla have direct business contacts with people in Montana, and they own property here. So they're heavily invested in Montana, and therefore the court should have jurisdiction over them. And so in this decision, this recent decision that you referred to, the court reversed its earlier finding and said, yes, DEQ does have the authority to enforce the bad actor law. And that's the whole reason that bad actor law It basically was signed into law after this Pegasus Gold bankruptcy to protect citizens from being in the position where they have to go in and clean up a mine. And the mine owners can just form another company, put somebody else in charge, or come back years later and try to do the same thing again. So it's a good decision for us. What we really don't know at this point, we have a new governor, Greg Gianforte, who, unlike our previous governor, Steve Bullock, strongly supports both the Rock Creek and the Montanore mines, and whether his DEQ will enforce the bad actor law remains to be seen at this point. But we did get a good decision.
So that's the kind of the next thing to wait and see, is if the DEQ is going to try to enforce this. Is there another, can they appeal? Can Hecla appeal this one?
Well, I suppose, I mean, that would not surprise me. But they may also be, this is speculation, they may be just waiting to see whether they need to or not. You know, whether DEQ is actually going to do anything.
And these costs of doing mine cleanups after mine companies go out of business, that falls to the government, right?
Yeah, ultimately the taxpayers. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know, there's bonds and so forth for Rock Creek, but they don't cover perpetual pollution, and they don't cover impacts to Idaho's waters.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary Costello with the Rock Creek Alliance, we have just a few minutes left here, but I did want to ask you a couple questions that I think, you know, proponents of the mine might have. We've been talking about some of the potential detrimental impacts of the mine, but it would create a lot of jobs. Hecla, I think, is projecting it would create 300 jobs. What would the Rock Creek Alliance's response be to those who say we simply need the jobs and the economic benefits that they would provide?
Well, you know, it's a little more complicated. I guess I would look at that and say, okay, how many of those jobs are just initial construction jobs and how many of those are long-term? And then out of those jobs, how many of those are actual local people being hired? You know, in a lot of cases with underground mining jobs, it's not something that everybody's trained to do, and typically people come into an area from outside seeking those types of jobs. And, you know, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware, there's the whole boom and bust cycle that is one of the problems with these mining jobs, is that there is this temporary boom, but, you know, eventually it leads to a bust. And that's one of the impacts that was talked about early on, was that this mine would set back the local economy here in Sanders County, Montana, for decades. That's not something that's really been talked about since then. And, of course, you know, I understand the need for jobs, but I think there are sustainable jobs. And if you look at this beautiful area, I think there's a lot of potential for long-term jobs that, as I said, are more sustainable.
Mm-hmm. We'll put out one more argument in favor, potentially, of the mine. It says, the country and the world just need raw materials and metals, which in this case would be copper and silver. What would your reply to that be?
Well, certainly we all use metals. And, you know, there's even a broader conversation that if you want to get into really talking about some of the rare earth metals and the strategic metals. But here we are talking about copper and silver, and those are minerals that can be recycled. And I think we need to have that broader conversation, not just about copper and silver and this project and the Montanore project, but some of the other mines right now that are being proposed, like the big lithium mines that are going to be used for our green technology. It's something that we all need to be talking about. What is the cost of that? Where are appropriate places for mines? Certainly in the case of Rock Creek, a mine beneath a wilderness perched on a major watershed is not an appropriate place, and I don't think that there's a strategic need for that copper and silver.
Okay. Well, anything else you'd like to tell listeners about the Rock Creek Alliance or the Rock Creek Mine?
Yeah, I would just encourage people to, if they're interested, to check out our website, and there's a way they can contact me. I think there's an email address on there if they have questions. We are, of course, a small nonprofit, and this last year has been financially challenging for us, as I think it's been for most nonprofits, and we really do rely on the support of our local community and members. So I would encourage people that would like to help, they can join through our website. And I guess the last thing, we are planning an annual gathering. And at this point, it's still in the early stages, but we're hoping to hold it on August 27th at the Matchwood Brewery. That's subject to change, but that's a tentative date, and it is open to the public.
Mm-hmm. So mark that down as a potential, a tentative date there, August 27th at Matchwood. You always give a presentation there. People can ask questions, so it's a great opportunity for people to get informed. And the website address is rockcreekalliance.org. That's all one word. So people can go there and check that out. And Mary Costello with the Rock Creek Alliance, thanks again for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
We're speaking now with two of the individuals who are part of NAMI Far North. We have Dawn Mira with us. She's the president. Dawn, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Catherine Perus. Catherine, you're a licensed clinical professional counselor, a national certified counselor, as well as treasurer for NAMI. Catherine, thank you for being with us.
Yes, I am. It's my pleasure.
Well, I'll get us started by telling listeners that NAMI is an acronym for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And NAMI Far North is our local chapter. I believe you cover Bonner and Boundary counties. Your group is here to support individuals and families that have been affected by mental illness. Dawn, let's start with you. Tell us more about your mission.
So we provide support, education, and advocacy for people with mental illness, their family members, and their friends. And we try to do that also, not just supportively for chronic issues, but also acute crisis situations. We also like to elevate the level of sensitivity and knowledge of mental illness, including things like law enforcement agencies, maybe healthcare professional information. We also try to have people understand their rights and also the policies at local and state and actually national level to accomplish all these objectives. There's a lot going on.
It is. Well, Catherine, maybe over to you on this question. So how many people in Bonner and Boundary counties are affected by mental health issues?
Well, the national average is 1 in 4 individuals will experience a mental illness during their life, because a mental illness does not always have to be chronic. You can have a situational type of thing, such as loss of a job, divorce, family death, that can tip someone over into the clinically depressed or clinically having anxiety. So it is 1 in 4 people across the nation. So that ties in still with Bonner County.
And is depression the prime sort of mental illness that people have to work with?
This last year and a half, it's been primarily general anxiety. I think there's a lot of contributing factors there. The COVID is certainly a huge one. The economic difficulties that people are having, loss of jobs, being laid off, all of those, and simply not knowing what next week is going to bring. Has been very trying for a lot of us in our community.
And those sorts of things can be really debilitating for some people, right?
Oh, absolutely. It just feels like it's too much to even go out because you don't know what's going to happen.
Specifically relating to the pandemic, has there been like a uptick, I assume, in cases?
In my private practice, I've seen an uptick in anxiety. To an extent, it coincided with the Medicaid expansion, which occurred, and more adults are covered than ever before. And so we're seeing a lot of individuals with really debilitating anxiety, and that increased in 2020 significantly.
Well, Don, let's go back to you. Tell us, I know you have monthly meetings with NAMI Far North. Tell us a little bit about what your meetings are about and how people, you know, interact with the organization.
The meetings are, we usually host a speaker during those meetings, that somebody that wants to talk about something related to mental health. And it could be exercise, it could be a political arena type thing that, you know, something new on the horizon for mental health care. But we usually have one every month. And then after that meeting, we have a support group for family members that they get to share in a private atmosphere. And we have a system that we use to share that's very equitable and also private at the same time, so that people leave feeling really good. And that's one of the reasons that I came to that, to know NAMI, is through their support group. Because everyone has, at some point, knows someone that has mental illness, and it can affect your life just as much as theirs. So that's one part of the support group. The other is for, we call people that have a mental illness, we call them consumers. And so we have a group setting for them as well that they can share. And those are people that are generally not in a crisis, that are in recovery. And that is something that I didn't know about when I started working with NAMI, is that there is such a thing as recovery. It's mostly what people see are the ones that people that are on the street that are maybe not able to take their medication for whatever reason, and they aren't functional. And there are so many people that are living successfully with mental illness that we want to share that with the rest of our community so that there's some hope.
Mm-hmm. So how big is your membership? And I guess goes to the question, how do you become a NAMI member?
We pay our members.
That's one way to get membership right there. Yeah.
We lost a few members during the pandemic because it's just so isolating for everyone that everybody just kind of crawls under the covers, I guess. But we do have a membership that, what is it like, between 15 and 40 at any one year. I think our board members are really strong in general, and so they do a lot of the education and support. And then we have a lot of volunteers that really help us with things like advertising and putting together fundraisers and things. We also do all kinds of really neat activities for, say, one of them is during Christmas, we'll do a Christmas card, kind of like a little party, and we'll write cards out to the people that are in the mental health state hospital. And we send them gifts and things like that. So we do a lot of outreach, and we also do a lot of stigma control and campaigning against stigma, if that helps you at all with what's going on with our general thing. But yeah, the meetings are pretty supportive. They're the core of our group, don't you think, Catherine?
I do. And if you want more information and you want to become a member of NAMI, you can go to NAMI, NAMI.org, and join there. We have family, individual, and then we also have an open door, which is a very reduced fee of $5 for a year's membership. and that gets you the NAMI Advocate magazine every month, as well as voting privileges, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, and that is to go to the national organization, but you actually have a local website as well, namifarnorth.org. And there is a link through there to go ahead and join up as well. And people can see a lot more information about the local chapter and your activities, annual reports, who your board members are, and so on. So it's a very informational website.
Well, in May, we just resumed in-person meetings. So we had our first in-person meeting May 19th, I believe. And we are planning on continuing with those going forward.
Yeah, they're every other Wednesday. I mean, every third Wednesday of the month.
Every third.
VFW. So that would be June 16th.
Okay. And we actually are recording this just a couple days before that. So folks won't be able to make the June issue, but the third Wednesday in July would be an opportunity to go to one of the meetings. And of course, they can get a hold of you through the website in advance of that if they're listening. I think you have an event coming up that you wanted to tell folks about as well.
Yeah, this is a real good one. It's called NAMI Family and Friends. And we do, and we're actually doing an in-person presentation this month, which is so nice. But we also will do Zoom. So we're going to combine it this month. And what this Family and Friends is we share general information about mental health. So we do skills that you can use at home to help with communication, managing stress, self-care, crisis preparation. We also give you a whole slew of science facts about some of the severe mental illnesses that affect people, some of the basic ones like bipolar disease, schizophrenia. We talk a lot about anxiety. And we'd really like to use our lived experience in this program so that you're not just hearing rote facts, you're hearing from my partner, Amber Snoddy, and me about what was going on in our house during these crises and how we dealt with them and what worked and what didn't work. I feel like it's a really valuable session. It's free. And our next session is going to be June 25th, which is a Friday from 12 to 1:30. And that is going to be at the CREC, the Envision Center out on McGee Road. They have a new name.
Yes. The Community Envision Resource Center. Yeah, our Community Resource and Vision Center. One of those two. It's what we knew as the Sandpoint Community Resource Center previously, but now they've expanded their operation. And as you mentioned, they're on McGee Road, which is in actually Kootenai. It's right adjacent to the big Lighthouse corporate headquarters. And so your meeting will be at that location on June 25th.
Yes, and we're going to try to do a concurrent Zoom so that people that are living out of town, we had a lot of out-of-towners for our last one because it was all on Zoom. So we just thought we'd keep that so that they don't have to travel to us. So you're welcome to do that. I don't know how we would post a link, but it'll probably be on our website.
Or people can contact NAMI at namifarnorth2003@gmail.com for more information and specifics on registering.
Okay. And as well, you do have a Facebook page. It's just facebook.com/namifarnorth. People can go there. You might want to stick up an event posted on your Facebook page, but that's a good place for people to find out more about things as well. And this is open to everybody. It's, I'm guessing it's free.
It's totally free. And it's a lot of information. You're going to learn a lot. And maybe you'll have more questions after. We do have a session where we can answer questions.
And this is a good thing for people to go to that have maybe be, they're working with a family member that's suffering some problems right now. Is that correct, Dawn?
Yeah, family members. We also have work people that are working with people that have mental illness. They want to know more about their employees or their coworkers so that they can have a better connection, I guess, and maybe help them in a time of crisis if they need to. Some people don't. Some people with mental illness don't have family members. They only have friends. And so these are the people that we traditionally haven't been able to reach because our old seminar was a family to family. So we couldn't invite friends legally. And they've just opened it up. And I think that's just so nice. Because even the resource center itself, the people there have to deal with folks who have some mental health issues, and it's hard for them to figure them out sometimes and help them.
Yes. Catherine, I'll come back to you on this question. Several years ago, we had some really sad cases where young people took their own lives here in our community. And that really seemed to wake the community up about mental health issues and, you know, setting up some frameworks that we could help people when they do go in that sort of crisis. Am I accurate about that? Has the community kind of started to engage more in this way? And are there things that people should be watching out for just in their day-to-day lives with their friends or family?
Well, there's a number of things. People are far more aware than they were that year. And the schools are more integrated. We have Idaho Live program here locally, which is a high school and middle school program for suicide prevention. I think everyone's become more aware and more conscious of things to watch for and to ways that they can support people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so you have an event coming up. That's Friday, June 25th, noon to 1:30 p.m. at the Community Resource and Vision Center at 130 McGee Road in Kootenai. Folks can see more about you at NAMIFarNorth.org or on Facebook at NAMIFarNorth. Anything else that you would like to let people know about, Dawn or Catherine?
I think for me, I just want to make sure that the audience knows that one thing I discovered when I had a mental health crisis in my own family is that they're actually medical illnesses. They're just like physical illnesses. And I think that the more we understand that, the better it's going to be, the better our world is going to be, because they do need to be treated, sometimes with medication, sometimes with therapy. And they're really not the fault of anyone other than their brain isn't sometimes wiring right. And something has impacted them to cause the brain to have a problem. And they're not anything to be ashamed of. And I think that our little organization has been so welcoming for people that struggle with this, that it's just like a breath of fresh air when you walk into this group. So I want to encourage people to just come in and say hello.
Okay. Catherine, anything you'd like to add before we check out here?
We are going to be having in July 2 free movie events at the local theater. I would encourage people to check our website or Facebook for specific dates and times. We have chosen movies that do focus around mental health issues, but we've tried to pick a little bit lighter ones for the first movie event that we're doing. And so we look forward to seeing lots of people being able to come to that.
Okay. And did you say a local theater? Do you mean the Panada?
Yeah. No, not the Panada, cinema.
Okay. Sandpoint Cinemas. Okay. Great. So folks can watch for that as well.
Absolutely. We welcome everybody, and it will be free.
Okay. Well, Don Mira, president of NAMI, and Catherine Bruce, treasurer and counselor, I want to say thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks so much.